Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Our friend and co-presenter, Mike Jackson, isn't with us for the next few episodes, but he'll be back soon. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Only Murders in My Mind. I have my friend and co-presenter with me again, Liz. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Carol.
And there's still a gap where Mike should be.
Yes.
He's still not recovered, so we'll keep you up to date on that. Today, we're going to talk about crafting the perfect villain. Ooh.
I'm not scared.
No. My husband gets very scared when I start talking about crafting the perfect villain. As I say, I was going to give him this brooch because it's one eye, this brooch. And then he said he could sleep with one eye open, you see. When I'm sat up writing and saying, yeah, if I cut your throat now, how far would the blood go? And he's like, anyway.
before let's have a happy marriage.
Before we get into that, we're just going to talk about what we are actually doing with our own writing.
Yes. What are you up to, Carol?
I have just finished my first draft of my fourth Warrington Detective book. Ooh. And I am now going through the edit, which I will go through quite a few times. It's Liz and I both paint as well, and I don't know if Liz finds this, but it's very hard to stop sometimes and go, it's done.
Oh, I am a chronic fiddler. I'll be like, just one more bit. Oh dear, I didn't mean that to happen.
Yeah.
It's the story of my painting life, that is. Grab the paper towel.
Yeah, so we both do that. It's knowing, you know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
Yes, at least with editing you have an undo button. If I had one of those when I was painting, things would be a lot simpler.
Well, this is it. You can just go delete, 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 delete. Mm. So I've still got, obviously, a lot of work to do. And you'll hear writers say this, that the work starts with the editing. I don't know whether you agree with that or not, Liz.
Kind of, yeah, because it feels like for me, I know this isn't the same for everyone, but I feel like, yeah, the drafting is the fun bit where I get to tell myself a story. And it's like, you know, this is good. Oh, I like this. And then, you know, editing happens with a different part of your brain, the critical bit of your brain that goes, ooh, you've used two twice in that sentence. You need to fix that.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah, I do that. I look and I've got the same word in a sentence. So then I have to look for the word that means the same thing, but is a different word.
Yes, and then you put that in and realise you've used it again in the next paragraph. Yes. So it's back to the drawing board. Yeah.
Mm. Well, what I do now, I actually put my headphones on and let the automatic speech.
Oh, yes.
Read it back to me. And I think, even though it's very, you know, it's very monotone and there's no feeling in the voice, it does actually make me catch on to things I've done wrong more quickly that way than actually just reading through it. But that's just a process I do. Mm-hmm. What about yourself? You're always busy with your writing.
Everyone's busy.
Okay,
well, I've just finished reading through the first draft of Booker and Fitch Book 5. So I've completed Murder at Work. So yes, that's gone back to Paula. She's read it once, I've read it once, and now she gets it back again. And we will keep doing that like it's a volley at Wimbledon until we're both absolutely sick of it. And then hopefully we'll also be happy with it. So there's that. And now I am reading through the first draft of The Spirit of the Law, Book 3. So this is the one with my ghost police officer. And I can tell you now that it has a title, and I've also been working on the cover. So busy. But that's now going to be called The Case of the Lost Treasure.
And we're looking forward to seeing that out. It'll be a while yet, won't it?
It'll probably be a little while, yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's a shorter book, so it won't take, I hope, as long to edit. Yeah. So that's what I've been up to. And I should, hopefully, get all my editing notes done by the end of this week. And then I'll be putting them into practice. And then it goes to beta readers.
Yes.
So that's...
We like it when it goes to beta readers.
That's where we're at.
Yeah, and as I say, our good friend and co-host Mike, we're hoping he's getting on him with his novella. But
yeah, it should be done by now.
It should be done by now.
If we can, we'll bring you an update next time.
Yeah, we will. So, again, this is a question. When we do talks, we do talks at libraries and for, well, basically anybody that'll have us on this. You know, if somebody, you know, if a group is interested in one of us or all three of us coming to do little talks, we do them quite happily, as long as we don't have to travel too far. You know, going to London might be pushing it a bit. This is the sort of question that we get asked, and it's crafting the perfect villain. How do we go about that? Is there such a thing as the perfect villain, Liz, do you think?
No, I think it's probably in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? So
I'm going to say we want our villains to be clever.
Oh, yes.
We want them to outthink the police to a certain point, or whoever is detecting them. It doesn't necessarily have to be the police. It is in my books, but it could be somebody who is a nosy neighbour or, you know, lives in a boat, book, barge.
That's the one.
Or something like that. Mm. But we've all got villains that I think stick in our mind and we go, oh, yeah, they were really good. Now, I'm talking here about ones that we've read because, I mean, obviously a really good actor can portray somebody as being really horrible, but it's from a book we're talking about, that the sort of thing that we that sticks in our minds from when we've read books. Is there any particular one that you jumps to mind with you?
Hopefully this isn't a spoiler, but a kind of an early one for me was Count Fosco in The Woman in White.
Right.
Because he's, you know, he's unusual. He's, you know, a big character. He's charming. You know, he seems so nice. And it's like, oh, you know, are we making a terrible mistake here? But another one, I suppose, I'm going slightly off piste here. We'll come back to this character in a bit. Professor Moriarty.
Oh, yes.
As played by Andrew Scott in the BBC Sherlock.
Oh, menacing.
He was menacing, and he was larger than life most of the time. Yeah. And I don't know if you recall this, but I think one of the later episodes, basically Sherlock is being hounded, and you know, it's insinuated that he's built all this stuff up about this poor actor and saying that he's this villain. And there's this moment in it where Sherlock has gone to speak to a reporter. And then all of a sudden, you know, someone lets themselves in, and Moriarty kind of wanders into the fray and going, oh, they didn't have semi-skim milk, so I got this. And he does this double take. It's him at Sherlock, and it's so convincing. And you're like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, and you genuinely like, but he couldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, and he is so very convincing. And he just seems like this, you know, ordinary, you know, slightly distracted, nice guy who's, you know, gone to the shop and come back again. And
it's
when it completely throws you.
Yeah. And it sends a chill up your spine when you, when you see somebody that's a bit menacing and a bit, you know, you think, I wouldn't want to go for a drink with that person. I wouldn't like to meet them in a dark alley, all those sorts of things. It's when you think, that could be one of my mates. Ooh. And then they do something really, really sort of horrific, and it makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up.
So do you have any particular villains you like?
Well, again, I like Moriarty, and I like the thought of because he plays different roles. I know Sherlock plays different roles in the original books. He gets all disguised and everything, doesn't he?
Oh, he does. Yeah, he's the master of disguise.
Well, exactly. But Moriarty was much more devious, and you know, It's just so clever.
It's interesting, though, with Moriarty, because he's largely not there at all.
Oh, he isn't. He doesn't come up into it very much.
Which is probably one of the reasons why, you know, you can kind of project what you want onto him.
Yeah, because the scary
things... And lots of summer school writers have done.
Yeah, and it's what you don't see. It's what's going through your mind that, yeah. You know...
It's this insinuation that, you know, you may not see him, but he's at the centre of a web of...
Yeah,
you know, crime and horror and exploitation. Ooh.
But the character from Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal, and I've watched that film about 3 times now.
Mm.
Read the book, watched the film, and there's still bits of it. I have to close my eyes, and I'm like, oh, you know, it's just he puts the fear of everything into you when he's talking to you. You know, he goes.
Oh, don't.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, at a genuine moment then. Ooh.
Yeah, it's just...
It's a good joke. It's not the evening. I'll be worried about going to sleep after this, I think.
You've made a comment about when we were talking about being people gaslighting. That can be very unsettling, can't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's one of the things for me about, you know, a villain. I like it when they're ambiguous and you just can't be sure about, like with, you know, the Moriarty thing I just mentioned. And that thing of, you know, have I forgotten this? Am I being gaslit? You know, did it even really happen? Have I misremembered this?
Mm.
You know, and that stuff is, you know, can be so powerful and so wicked. And there's a book I'm thinking about, and I'm not going to say which book, but it's a classic novel, and you know, someone's got married, and you know, there's these rumors about I think they get married, the wife, and it's, you know, oh, she couldn't possibly have done that, it must have been a coincidence, she's, you know, she's so lovely and she's so concerned about me. Mm. And I won't tell you what happens in the rest of it, you can probably guess.
Yeah, so, yes. But there's the true story, and I can't remember the name of the guy. I've rewatched it recently in True Crimes. And he wanted to train to be a priest, and he kept befriending people and then killing them for their money.
Yeah. Ah, right. You know, I did wonder where that was going.
That's a true story. This person is now in prison, but he came over as this lovely, kind, meek and mild, religious person. And he was getting very close to people that he knew had money.
Yeah.
And getting them to change the wills and all this stuff.
Is that worse or more powerful than when they're kind of larger than life people?
I think that's worse in a way, because you could turn around and say, well, we all know somebody, not that is trying to kill you.
Hopefully not.
But so, well, I know somebody like that. It's that thing, isn't it, when you go, I never thought they were capable of doing that. You know, it's really... People that live next door to mass murderers. And then, oh, he seemed ever so nice.
Indeed.
He helped me take the bins out. Yeah, but you don't know what was in the bin. That's the thing. Mm. It's our villains. They believe that they're heroes. They're doing the right thing. Mm. I've just started watching a series on television about a... And I'm trying to remember the name of it now. A man who works for the police in America doing blood splatters.
Blood splatters?
Yeah, he looks at the splatter of blood and he can tell where the direction of the blow came from.
Oh, okay. And I was going to say, I thought you meant some kind of, you know, Jackson Pollock, Mary McCullough sort of.
Well, they do look like that. But he is killing people who have murdered somebody and then got off with it. He actually kills them.
Oh, right.
So he's a bit of a monster, but to everybody around...
It's like Dexter.
That's Dexter.
There we go.
I was trying to remember what it was called. But to everybody around him, he seems like this mild-mannered... I sound like I'm trying to describe Superman. But this mild-mannered... And there's this internal dialogue going on all the time with him, you know, I don't feel anything. So we're going to get on to hear about the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath.
Ooh, right. Go on then.
So a sociopath is somebody that does not feel empathy for somebody else and is a very... they're all about themselves. They don't really think about what other people think about them, especially.
Yeah.
And in some of the portrayals of Sherlock Holmes, he comes over as being a sociopath.
Mm.
He doesn't have any empathy. He's very, very clever. He's always right. Nobody else is right. He's always right. But when we get to the psychopath, they really believe what they are doing is the right thing.
Mm.
And, you know, killing could be part of the sort of profile, if you like.
Mm.
And I suppose they can be both. They can be a sociopath and a psychopath at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's this thing that says that it's shown in early development with a psychopath. They'll start killing animals and things like that, you know, mm. and it's, yeah. As I say, I'm really fascinated with the way the mind works, especially when we're looking at mass murderers, because there's a sort of thing I write.
Indeed you do.
So what makes a good villain, in our opinion? I think it's, I think it's when, I've said before, when we're looking at crime fiction, they usually, it goes two ways. It goes either, you know from the get-go who the villain is,
mm.
but they're so clever they can cover everything up. And the police are desperately scrambling about trying to prove mm. this person. Or we don't know, we have the reveal mm. at the end.
Which do you prefer?
The reveal at the end, I think.
Same here, I think.
Especially as a writer, I do. I've never tried to write one where I've said, you know, this is the person that's doing the killings at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I like to try and lead people down different paths and give them some opportunity towards the end to be able to guess who the killer is.
Yeah. I've read a book, kind of like the first case scenario you mentioned, where, you know, there's someone who is so obviously a wrong'un, but always, you know, they have an alibi. It couldn't have been them.
Mm.
But you know, you absolutely know they are mixed up in this somehow, and it is a matter of working out how.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, the police have got, you know... I'm not
naming books, so I don't want to give spoilers.
No. The police, I've spoken to quite a lot of policemen when I've been doing research, etc. And they will say, we knew Mr. B did it, or Mr. A, or Mr. X.
Mm.
We just couldn't prove it.
Ooh.
We knew that they'd done it. But you can't take somebody to court just because you've got a feeling.
No. Yeah, I'm not sure that would stand up, would
it? No, no. Mm. And it's up to them to... find the proof, and that's what we do in our writing. I mean, as I say, your crime fiction is comes under the genre of cosy murder mysteries.
Generally, yes.
But you do leave that open for people to follow the clues, don't you?
I certainly try to. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I've read them all, and I. A couple of them I didn't guess at all. I was like, wow, I didn't see that coming.
It's one of the questions I always ask, did you guess who did it? You
but know. some of them I have got, but it's been really right towards the end of the book, which is is what you want.
Well, that's the thing, I always want to give the reader a fair chance. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing as disconcerting as, and we've said this before, reading a book and then at the end they go, oh, it was the son and he's been living abroad for the last 20 years. He just popped up out of it and he's not been in the book at all to that point.
Mm,
you know, it's a bit of a get out, isn't it?
Yeah. What do you think detracts from a good villain? What would kind of make you, you know, finish a book and go, pfft, you know?
If all the way through, and I didn't know they were the villain at that point, they were unlikable.
Okay.
I want to be empathetic with the villain to some degree. Mm. You know, oh, they've had a hard life. You know, the whole family was wiped out in the tsunami in Thailand, and they've had a real struggle, and mm-hmm. you know, it couldn't possibly be them. They've come through so much, you know, and that, as I say, the cats are disappearing and rabbits are disappearing from hutches and things like that. Mm. And you're thinking, no, like you said, it can't be them. They've had such a tough time, and they've been so brave, but they haven't really, because they're taking it out on everybody else. You know, it's that sort of thing. Mm. And I think when we do hear in this country of, especially of mass murder, and you know, there's different ones that we've happened in the last sort of 20 or 30 years, we are A, appalled, and B, absolutely fascinated. We just want to know how it happened. How did they get away with it?
Yes.
You know, what did they do to...
Yeah. Was everyone looking the other way all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Dr. Shipman.
Oh, yes.
To name but one. You know, trust me, I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
And people did, because he came...
That's the thing with hindsight. You know, it's very easy for us. Did nobody see the signs? And, you know, clearly.
No.
No.
Yeah. And again, it's this thing. I mean, there's recently the nurse who was killing the babies, and everybody said the reason nobody suspected her was because she was this grey, shadowy person who wasn't. She just sort of faded into the background. Mm-hmm. She wasn't gregarious. She didn't want to have a laugh with people. She was quite a serious person. Mm-hmm. She seemed to do a job well, you know, that sort of thing. So she was nondescript. She was sort of just in the background and blending in with everybody. But I'm wondering if you've got anything that we could hear from one of your books that sort of emphasises this sort of thing.
Well, I've got a bit. It's difficult, really, when you're picking a bit with the villain, because
you don't want to give it
the
away.
Problem is, you don't want to say who the villain in your book is. So, you know, because, you know, you might want to read it one day, possibly. I think one of the things for me that detracts from a good villain is I don't like it when people are bad for no reason. Like, I want them to have some kind of motivation that makes sense to them.
Mm.
You know, even if it doesn't make much sense to me, even if it's some ridiculous, you know, grudge or hang up or something. Yeah, just... When they don't know I'm being bad because I can be, Yeah, I don't really like that. I want them to have a reason for doing what they do.
Logically, they think it's the right thing to do, even though we all know that, you know, murdering 20 people is not the right thing to do.
Okay, I'll try and grab a bit. Right, I'm going to read a bit from, this is from one of the Castor and Fleet books, and this is book 3, The Case of the Deceased Clark. And in this one, Catherine and Connie are investigating all sorts of dodgy characters, in the sense of spiritual fakers. So, you know, iffy fortune tellers, dodgy mesmerists, that sort of thing. Because there were lots and lots and lots of those hanging around in the late Victorian period, and no doubt tricking people out of their fortunes and all sorts of things. So, this isn't the main villain of the piece, but it's someone who's distinctly a bad lot. And this is a mesmerist called the Sphinx. So I'll read a bit of that and about some of his modus operandi. And hopefully it'll be extremely unpleasant. So enjoy. Okay, here we go. The lights lowered and soft music began to play, though no musicians were visible. It had a steady beat like a dance tune, slightly out of kilter with my heart. A deep voice echoed around the room, bouncing from corner to corner. The Sphinx, the Sphinx, the Sphinx. Your thoughts are his. Ventriloquist, whispered Connie. People around us tutted and shushed. Lights illuminated a tiny part of the stage. A man was seated, his elbows on the chair arms, studying the audience over steepled fingers. A voice, low yet distinct, spoke. An engagement ring, a wedding planned, a troubled young woman. It was impossible to pinpoint the source of the voice, even knowing it came from the figure on stage. He stood up and scanned the auditorium. His eyes swept over me and back. I felt myself fighting not to stand. It was like being in a classroom when you've done something wrong and you're trying to avoid the teacher's eye. But it was Geraldine who stood. "Here I am," she said. And now the narrative moves to Connie. I nudged Catherine and pointed at the slim form of the woman standing in the row in front. Do you know her? Shh, Connie, hissed Catherine, her eyes fixed on the woman's back. But she... Please, Catherine whispered. The Sphinx's pale eyes rested on the woman like a fly on a piece of cake. Here you are, he said, urbanely. Suddenly he frowned and placed his fingers to his temples, and his gaze seemed to intensify. And yet you are not. An ah from the audience. I sense that, in one way, you are not the person I seek, not the person whose thoughts wheel and flutter like a bird trying to escape from its cage. Ooh, he's good, murmured Ernestine. And yet, in another way, you are. Ernestine nudged me. Here we go, she said, settling in her chair as if we were watching a play. She grinned at the volley of shushes from all sides. You are a young woman who feels she has escaped from something. I cannot see what, because your mind has tried to shut it away. It appalls you. It disgusts you so much that you cannot bear to think about it. Yes, whispered the woman, her shoulders twitching in a way that suggested she was wringing her hands. Is that right? I cannot quite hear you. Yes. She put hands over her mouth. She thought it was gone, all gone, but something or someone has brought it back into your mind. Gasps from the audience and murmurs. Am I right? She swallowed. Tell me, my dear, tell the Sphinx. I felt Catherine shifting in her seat beside me. If she even thinks about it. You are right. It was... Catherine half rose, and as she did, the Sphinx held up a hand. You do not need to tell me what I already know. The Sphinx removed his hands from his temples and stretched them out to the lone woman, who trembled like a leaf. Let me connect with you further, my child. So far, I have only penetrated to a superficial level of your brain. Let me see more. Yes, yes. The woman sounded as if she was in some sort of ecstasy. Reach towards me. She raised her arms, leaning forward slightly. Turn your palms upward. She did as she was told. Ah, yes, that is better. The Sphinx's long, pale fingers seemed to glow in the limelight. Now I see. What do you see? I see a woman who ought to be happy, but she is not, because something is missing. Her cry was one of pain, as if someone had jabbed a sharp needle into her heart. Try and stay as still as you can, my dear, or you will break our connection. Suddenly the Sphinx looked down and his shoulders slumped. An oh of disappointment rippled through the audience like a wave. The Sphinx's hand returned to his temples. Wait, I have it. Yes, I see the problem and I know how you can solve it. Tell me, the woman cried. Please tell me. A slow smile curled the Sphinx's thin mouth. I cannot tell you in front of all these people. It must be a secret between you and me. But if you ask for me when the performance is concluded, I shall speak to you alone then. Dun, dun, dun.
It's interesting because I think because of social media and everything these days, if a so-called medium has a small group of people, they can do research into them, can't they?
Yes.
I mean, the things they can find out. What do you think they did in those days? Because they were very, very popular. Mm. Do you think they just stayed quite general?
I think they possibly did. I mean, in that example, you know, things about a young woman and an engagement and things like that. I mean, there were bound to be women in the audience, either of that age or, you know, thinking about an engagement or a broken engagement or possibly someone who was the parent of a young woman, et cetera, et cetera. So there'd be an awful lot of people in the audience you could prey on. And I imagine what you do is you watch the faces and you'll notice that he kind of puts the call out and then someone stands up. And there's probably more than one person who was going to, because I think Catherine was going to stand up as well, but luckily this other woman got there first.
So he's reading people's body and facial expressions.
I think so, yeah. And the thing is, he put the call out. It's not like, you're the one. He made the call and then she got up. So he hasn't really had to do much work.
No.
And everything he said was so very ambiguous.
Yeah.
But, you know, the audience are invested. There's this tense atmosphere. It's been set up.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've seen some of Darren Brown's shows where he'll do stuff like that.
No, I've not.
And he'll do like what they call a cold reading.
Yeah.
Yeah. And afterwards, the people will say, I don't know how he knew that, But they've told him the whole thing.
Mm.
You know, he'll say some kind of very and they'll go, yes, that's exactly it. Yes, yeah. I'm like, you know, my mother had a hamster just like that or whatever it happens to be, you know.
Oh.
And then afterwards they'll be like, he knew my mother had a hamster. You know, how on earth
did he
get that? How could he know that she had a ginger and white hamster called Biffy?
Yeah.
You know, and they leave amazed.
Yeah.
So
I must admit, when I was working on the Teams platform,
yeah,
I very often felt like I was holding a seance. Hello, is there anybody there? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You know,
especially when you can't see any faces and you've got names or blank screens.
I know, yeah. So it did feel a bit like that. Well, I'm going to read a little bit
out of
my book. This one is really staging the scene for... an investigation more than anything. Becky Wainwright is a detective with the Cheshire Serious Crime Squad, and she is investigating at the moment a second horrific murder that was carried out, or the body was found in the sleepy village of Stockton Heath. Don't let them fool you.
Indeed. All your murders are horrific, Carol.
Yeah, true. And she's just... had enough, so she goes to one of the local cafes, because there is quite a few in Stockton Heath.
There are
very
many.
Nice, mm-hmm. Yes. Just to catch up on her emails on her phone and have a coffee. So Becky was fed up. Too much wine last night was now tapping on her shoulder and telling her she needed coffee and painkillers. Just around the corner from the murder site was the middle-class suburb of Stockton Heath, with overpriced houses and too many cars, which also had a collection of small boutiques, restaurants, and more importantly, coffee shops. Becky headed for one now. It was a cold, bright day today, not the kind of weather for grisly murders. Bluebells and daffodils were poking their heads above the ground to see if they could come out to play yet. The first coffee emporium she saw was called 24/7, so she went in. The bell rang as she entered, and she was welcomed by the smell of coffee beans, which made her mouth fill with saliva. "Morning, what can I do for you?" The man behind the counter was bright and cheerful, as the weather, which contradicted her melancholy feeling about life and death at the moment. "Americano, please, black with an extra shot." The place was buzzing. The downstairs was full of yummy mummies grabbing time with friends between school runs, housework, and probably high-flying careers. Becky tuned in to the nearest table. "I told Gordon we'd have to wait for the document until after the school holidays. I said, I do have a life, you know." Becky decided her deductions were spot on, but then she was a detective. "Staying in?" the man asked as he punched his till. "What? Oh, sorry, yes, I'll go upstairs. Right, I'll bring it up. That'll be £3, please." Becky played and escaped the jolly chatter for the first floor, which was still busy but much quieter. She found a table by the window. Nearby, two comfortable settees and an armchair were occupied by a group of seven people, two women and five men. One of the women was talking. "I didn't know if the blood would come off, and my heart started to race." Becky stared at her, not quite believing what she was hearing, and then realised with some relief that the woman was reading from a notebook, and it wasn't, presumably, some sort of group confession. "Murderers Anonymous," Becky smiled at that. She took out her phone and pretended to check it, but she was all ears to know what came next. "I heard sirens in the distance, and I knew then I would have to run because nobody was going to believe I hadn't done it." The woman looked up from her script and sighed. "Well," she asked, "what do you think? Be honest now." "I liked it," said a man in the group, "but I think it's moving a bit too fast." "Too fast," said the woman, looking pained. Obviously, she hadn't meant it when she'd asked for their honesty. "2 weeks ago, you said it was too slow. Make up your mind, Reuben." "It's not realistic enough for me," added another critic. "You need more blood, more gore, more sex." The second woman in the group spoke up. "We're not all looking for grisly murders, you know, David. Some of us happen to like cosy murder mysteries." "Rubbish. It isn't real crime," he spat. "We're supposed to be a crime writers group, not Midsummer Murder fan club." Becky was enjoying this little domestic when her coffee arrived. "Here we go," said the waiter. He put Becky's cup down and looked over at the now heated discussion. Now, guys, what's the problem? He asked. It's just Davy being a twat again, said the second woman. Then she smiled and the tension there a moment before dissolved into laughter. The group chatted to the waiter and Becky could tell they all knew each other. Anyhow, asked David, how's your bloodbath novel coming along? I've sort of stalled, said the waiter. I'm trying to work out how much blood a body can lose without the victim dying and how long they'd stay alive for. The young waiter was medium-sized with unruly hair that spilled over onto his eyes. Depends on body weight and gender. This came from David, who Becky had decided was a bit of a know-it-all. Becky was enjoying this diversion from her real job when her phone rang. DC Wainwright, she answered on automatic pilot and then realised the room had gone very quiet and every eye was upon her. So, yes, it used to be one of our favourite places for a coffee. We used to go in there quite a lot, didn't we?
We did, yes.
It wasn't called that, but I did get permission off the man who owns it and runs it to use his...
I do like that potential villainy, which then gets dissipated when you realise what they're really up to.
Yeah, yeah. To somebody who sort of...
are they?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Listening in, what would you think? That's the thing. Ooh. So I think that's probably it for this episode. Yes.
Hope you've enjoyed.
Yes, and once again, we would like to thank you for listening and hit the what's it, all the buttons.
Yeah, hit the buttons.
Hit the buttons.
Any buttons. Yeah. Mash them with your palm.
Yeah, just go for it. And we're very grateful that people are subscribing, etc. And we will see you again very soon. Bye for now.
Bye.
You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production, produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.